Is there anything that reaches out and grabs your memory's imagination whenever you see it? Even if it's just in an old photograph or even just in your mind's eye. Or when you hear something that takes you back to an indelible time or circumstance. Or when you pick up a particular aroma in the air. Or you taste something that takes you back to a certain table at a certain time. As we near Christmas time, and I get out the old records and everything, which I have nothing to play them on. I remember the enchantment of childhood with those magical vinyl discs. Like a lot of people in the early 1980s, I had a sizable record collection. Those old vinyl phonograph records, they were the primary mode of recorded music through most of the 20th century. There was just something about that whole experience. There were the 12-inch square record covers, and sometimes there'd be information printed on the dust jacket inside, and then you'd pull out the round disc and put it on the turntable. And boy, if you had your favorites, there was just this phenomenal sense of expectation as the disc spun and you got the arm ready to drop the needle. And when the needle landed in the groove, you'd hear that comforting, familiar crackle, almost like the crackle of a fireplace. And then it would still a little bit, and you just knew at that instant the beauty that was about to come out. But it was like you could hardly wait for it. I remember seeing on TV around 1980-something, there were a couple of executives from Sony, Japanese men, on one of the morning TV shows, and they were introducing in limited English the product that, after years as a data storage mechanism for corporations, was just about to go global as a home entertainment medium, compact discs or CDs. And I thought, that's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. That will never catch on. Eventually, they came to the last question of the interview, and the host of the show asked the executives, what about the vinyl records from which the music industry was making literally billions every year from people like me? And one of the gentlemen, searching momentarily for the right word, kind of brushed his hands through the air and said, obsolete. I thought about all the records in my collection. I thought, please tell me these guys are wrong. Well, they weren't wrong. But once digital music began to make its way into the market, sure enough, between CDs and vinyl records, there was just no comparison. I mean, the sound quality, I mean, forget it. It was just so much better. The rumble from the turntables, the rolling of the machine was kind of a constant noise under that. The crackle, sometimes the actual cracks in the vinyl, the scratches and everything, all of that was now gone. And suddenly there was such a purity of sound. Now you could hear instruments in the mix that had been buried under all the extraneous noise. I remember hearing somebody play an organ on a recording that I'd heard on a record for years and years. And on the CD, you could hear the keys being depressed on the instrument, even as you could also hear the actual music. The dynamic range was astonishing. It sounded like the musicians were right there in the room. On a lot of those old classic recordings, regardless of what genre they were in, classical, jazz, rock, whatever, the new purity of sound was a sonic revelation. The recordings were the same, but it was a brand new day for the mode or the medium in which those recordings were transmitted. It was newer and clearer and more suitable for the time. After a while, though, some brave souls began to confess, even as audiophiles, people who love the purity of sound, they kind of missed those faint crackles. They missed what they had never noticed before, that low rumble, which had a way of somehow blending all the sounds together like a woven blanket. The word warmth started to be used in a nostalgic way. Suddenly the euphoria over the newfound clarity of those recordings was tempered by a creeping sense that there was something missing, something that had been replaced by metal and wires and soulless technology. Even in the face of the incontrovertible improvement in the method of playing the recordings, the total improvement in sound quality by any measure, numbers of people began to realize how much they still valued and missed the old way anyway. It wasn't just a question of moving to the new and better thing. We also had to reckon with a newfound appreciation and longing for what had been before. The temple that Jesus and the disciples knew in their time had been there for 5 centuries. The central place in the lives of God's people, the high holy place of all that was sacred. The original temple, the first temple, had been built by Solomon almost 1,000 years before Jesus was born, and then was leveled by the Babylonians in 586 BCE. But after the Babylonian exile, the people of God had been allowed to return and build the second temple, which was completed in 515 BCE. And that was the one that Jesus and his disciples now knew. So, 500 years. Matter of fact, just a generation before then, Herod had made some additions to the temple to make it even larger and more imposing. So Jesus had been teaching there this morning. And on his way out, one of the disciples turned around and looked up at the beauty and the grandeur and the infinite layers of profound and beautiful meaning embedded in that great stone structure, and said to Jesus, "Look, teacher, what stones, what buildings." I can imagine the awe and the appreciation that that disciple might have been feeling. For all of their lifetimes and for centuries before they were born, the temple had meant something deep and profound and powerful, foundational. That stone structure was the place that defined the center of what made them one people, one unified nation. It was also the place of pilgrimage that gave shape to their individual lives. I was glad when they said to me, "Let us go to the house of the Lord." It was the one place where guilt and shame could be rectified. It was the place where you could go to learn the fundamental truths of the universe and how they applied to your everyday life. It was, for many of them, the presence of God in their midst. And now Jesus was saying, this temple, for all its grandeur, for all its venerability, for all its majesty and immovability, this temple is ultimately not an end in itself. Like all expressions of our belief and trust in God, it can only be, at best, something that points beyond itself toward the one who is worshipped there. He was saying these mighty stones and imposing buildings were never going to be permanent. The message they carry is eternal. But even the stones are only temporary. There will come a time when those structures and these great stones will no longer be adequate or relevant or even faithful. Which would seem to give us something to think about when it comes to the structures that we build out of stone, and I mean that literally or figuratively, as if they were so permanently relevant and faithful and adequate that they were just destined to last forever. My first year in college, I was assigned a roommate, a guy I'd never met from a place I'd never been. And during the course of that year, He became one of my best friends in the world. He was just a tremendous guy and a great influence on me. I was class clown in high school. I will admit that. Trumped up charges, but I was kind of the class clown. However, that persona was way out here in front, and the severely introverted person was way back here. And my roommate Mike, he was just by his enthusiasm and his gregariousness, just couldn't help but sort of bring me a little closer, the real Keith, a little closer to that persona. I valued him greatly, and I loved the guy. He was a great guy. It takes a while to get to know somebody, but we were stuck in the dorms together, so you might as well make the best of it, and we did. We developed that friendship. Neither one of us was very outwardly sentimental. So when the whole academic school year had gone by, and now it was moving out time, and finally time to say goodbye, and we knew that it would never really be the same again, we parted with a handshake and a promise to keep in touch. Over the next 3 years, Mike went his way and I went mine. Almost never saw each other. But one time when we were seniors, toward the end of the year, we kind of bumped into each other on campus somewhere, and we went and sat down and talked for a little bit. And it was just like I had always known, and I'm sure Mike had always known, that it would be. The talk was only small talk. The old inside jokes felt forced. And we really just didn't have that much in common. I had built a stone wall around that freshman year concept of who he was and who I was and what our friendship was. But as you know, those very young adult years are full of change and exploration and finding out who you are, sometimes adopting and discarding personas at a staggering rate. And we both knew that. And so after a while, we parted, again shaking hands. But this time it was the handshake of two guys who barely knew each other at all. That freshman year friendship is never too far from my mind, and I still have something of a stone wall around it, as if to keep it, if only in my memory, just as it was for that one incandescent year. But like all earthly things, it was ephemeral. In a world where so many things are ephemeral, fleeting, it's no wonder that we build massive stone structures. Sometimes we want to keep things as we are, and we want that so badly that we end up trying to entomb eternal things, including God and God's Word, in structures that we think ought to be permanent. The structure of our religious practice. Stone buildings, pipe organs, stained glass windows. Many of us used to think that those things, if you didn't have those, you didn't have church. Or the structures of how we think about each other, how we talk to and about one another. Like Peter learning that what God has made clean, no one must call profane. What God has made clean, including people who in our older structures we couldn't have accepted, let alone embraced. The structure sometimes even of our own theology. And Jesus says, do you see those great structures? Not one stone will be left upon another. All will be thrown down. Mark doesn't record the immediate reaction of the disciple who had stopped to gaze in awe and draw Jesus' attention to the mighty stones and the looming buildings of the temple. A little later, four of the disciples asked him, when is this going to take place? And it's easy to read the traditional translations that come down from King James all the way to New Revised Standard Version, to read those as if he's saying, well, you better hold on to your hats. Because there's going to be wars and rumors of wars and nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, earthquakes and famines and all that. And hang on to something, because that's just the beginning. In other words, it's easy to read it like he's saying, that's bad, but it's nothing compared to how bad it's going to get. But I am convinced that Mark has Jesus saying, yeah, when all that stuff happens, it's going to be rotten. You're going to have wars and famines and earthquakes and dissent and violence. It's going to be there. But it's not that everything is ending in some nightmare hellscape that God has willed. Just know that when you are going through it, that something beautiful is about to be born. As we go through life, we will from time to time suffer the loss of some of the things that we thought were permanent. Structures will be dismantled and stones will be separated. And sometimes that will be the work of the Holy Spirit, actively dismantling that which has served us well, but has performed its duty and completed its mission. When the forms that we are used to, in which we have invested so much of our hearts and our imaginations and our hopes and our dreams, when those forms are no longer the best or the most effective or even the most appropriate carriers of the message with which we have been entrusted, the Spirit brings us new things and stirs us to make new structures. Inevitably, at some point, it becomes time to acknowledge that and respond accordingly. I don't have Monterey Presbyterian Church. I don't have something I'm going to spring on you as it's going to be the whole new thing and we're destroying all the old. But you are hearing that we live in a time of great change, and the context of the world in which we minister is a very different context. But at the same time, I want to take a minute to stand next to that disciple whose jaw is agape at the magnificence, the beauty, the profundity of that old structure, the stones and the buildings of the temple. Standing with him, we can at least pause long enough to acknowledge the breathtaking feelings that are conjured up when we think about those structures that have meant so much to us. We had a guy in one of the churches I used to serve, phenomenal human being named Clyde Olin. In his late 90s, Clyde was still golfing on weekends and going to the grade school to read to the kids. He was gentlemanly and witty and on the ball. Clyde was kind of like a human time capsule. In his college yearbook, there were ancient black and white photographs of him in his days at Michigan State University in, I guess, the 1920s version of ROTC, which at that time was the Mounted Cavalry Corps. Clyde Olin as a young man on horseback. This was considered current military technology when Clyde was in college. As he neared the age of 100, everybody was kind of pulling for old Clyde. Around 98, 99, he started to slow down, and it was fairly quickly downhill. Physically, he made it to 100. There was a big party and everything. But when Clyde passed away a couple of months later, we knew that it was time. And God rest his beautiful soul. But partly because of the centenary watch that we'd all been carrying on for several years, I think many of us had subconsciously convinced ourselves that when that day finally came and it was time to let him ride his cavalry steed over the horizon one last time, that the whole world would respectfully stop just for a day or two and collectively take stock of the monumental century that Clyde had just taken with him. And in some part of my soul, anyway, it was weirdly and totally indefensibly a little bit offensive to me that the world didn't miss a beat. We held the service. I noted that on the day he was born, the Wright brothers hadn't made it off the ground yet. TV was still decades off, and email wouldn't happen for almost a full century. But the world itself just kept turning. But there in that church's sanctuary, we needed to stop and reflect and give thanks for what we had had. And I dare say that even as the Spirit gives us courage to jump into whatever future is in store for the church that may look very different from its past, it's important to take a moment and recognize within ourselves the longings for things we used to know, the memories we carry within us of people and places and things that once stirred our hearts to faithfulness and inspired us to love and to dig into pools of kindness and mercy and generosity. Of course, the world and the landscape in which Christianity brings its message is changing. We know the church has to do new things and be a different thing than it has been in order to speak into current and just over the horizon realities. And sometimes we ourselves have some stone buildings that need to be torn down if we're going to be useful in what God is doing in the world. Some of the things I had always thought were fundamental to who I am. Certain beliefs about people, certain understandings of the way the world is supposed to work. I think there are times when Jesus looks at those carefully constructed structures within each one of us and says, that all needs to come down so that you can hear me speaking directly to you again. And I say, but God, I've already determined what's good and correct and what you want with me and what you want to do in the world and what you want with the world. So like Peter on the mountaintop with Jesus, I'll build some permanent housing for you here in my heart, and it will never change, and then you won't ever have to change anything in me. And God says, as God said to David 3,000 years ago, are you the one to build me a house to live in? And God said to David, I'll appoint a place for my people. And I'll make you a house. Give thanks for those memories and the things that occasionally cause you to tap into those memories. God has reached out to you through your senses and is reminding you that truth and beauty are all around you and always have been. And give thanks, too, that God continues to reach out to you and is asking you to keep reaching out to the world, spreading good news, bearing a living message, not confined to walls that you or others built a long time ago, but free to go anywhere and everywhere that the Spirit will send you, always remembering that no matter what may happen, no matter what the world may look like on any given day at any time, something true and something beautiful is about to be born into the world.